Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. Well, if you're familiar with the name Topher Brophy, you probably also know he's handsome, four-legged, fur buddy, Rosenberg. Together, they share an Instagram page and all the fun that goes with that. And it is a really fun page. You can find that at Instagram.com/Topher Brophy. But they're known for dressing alike, and whether they're adorned in a stunning dress, a tiger costume, or even a skimpy Speedo, they look identical. It's really fun. Topher Brophy joins me today, though, to talk about his new book, and the title of the book tells you exactly what we talk about today, Dog Dad, How Animals Bring Out the Best in Us and Can Help Save the World. So a little bit about Topher Brophy. He and Rosenberg have almost 250,000 followers on Instagram. Together, they raise awareness about how animals can not only help spread joy, they help us heal mentally, physically, emotionally, and provide unconditional love and companionship. Dog Dad, How Animals Bring Out the Best in Us and Can Help Save the World is the book again. And I want to share that all author proceeds from the sale of Dog Dad are being donated to American Humane. So Topher Brophy really puts his money where his mouth is, so to speak. And let's hear from him right now, Topher Brophy. Topher Brophy, welcome to the show. Welcome.
Vicki, thank you. So honored to be with you and to hear your golden accent in my ears.
Well, I'm pleased to have you here, Topher, and I'm a massive dog lover, as our listeners know, and as many of our listeners are too. So I was very keen to read your book and enjoyed it, and I like the work that you're doing. The book is called Dog Dad, How Animals Bring Out the Best in Us and Can Help Save the World. And they certainly can help us emotionally and mentally, and I would say physically too. But before we dive into the heart of the dog end of the story, I want to just begin with a little of your background, because you share this quite openly and honestly in the book. You say that for the majority of your life, you found it quite painful to be a human, and that pain started early in life for you. So tell us a little about that, if you would.
Sure. I mean, it's one of those things where you kind of don't know if your baseline is off, if you have no reference for it. And I think for most of my life, I didn't really understand that people, you know, aren't supposed to feel out of place, aren't supposed to feel like they don't belong. I mean, many of us do anyway at certain points, but I think I felt it more than, I guess, most people. And I always had this kind of weight, this kind of almost existential angst from a very young age. And I kind of started when I realized that, you know, we're all going to die, you know, to be blunt. I never was able to really resolve that in my head as a young person. And it was one of those things where I just kept asking big questions and people didn't want to hear it. And I never felt fit in with my peer group when most kids were doing kind of normal kids play things. And I was kind of asking strange questions and they were quite heavy. And that's kind of how it first reared its head. And then it kind of continued as you know, we all have tough times as being humans and having brains and instincts, and again, knowing we're mortal. But as it continued to kind of raise its head as I evolved and grew, I just had, you know, growing pains, and probably everybody does. But I felt like mine, I just wasn't adjusting to social environments
right
for my childhood.
Right. And I mean, it's a very unusual thing, I think, for a kid to be so concerned with death. I mean, obviously, I think I can remember thinking back to my childhood and it crossed my mind, but it certainly wasn't something I was constantly thinking about.
Pretty dark.
Yes, it is. You say, You write in the book that you were 8 years old the first time you heard the word Asperger's. Your parents had taken you to see a doctor because there was some, I think it was put in the way of special traits or special specialties in the family. Tell us about that experience and what that meant to you.
Yeah, so I mean, it's one of those things where you go to see someone and you don't really understand all those things, and you take the words and they kind of get etched in your brain. And you know, there's people in my family that, you know, I didn't know the details of it, but just, you know, have a, you know, emotionally different kind of way that their brain works. You know, we can call it all these different things, but it's just, you know, people are different and they have they're wired differently. And I was one of those people, and I was, you know, diagnosed with that at a young age. You know, I didn't really understand what that meant, other than they said, you know, you probably can't do certain things in your life because you're X or you're Y. And the young person's age, when you're told that, it kind of makes you feel like you can and can't do certain things, which is really, really unhealthy. I think that didn't help, and I think that was probably, I think psychology and has probably evolved since that point, when they deal with people's personality traits and mood disorders and learning disabilities. I think that's probably a little antiquated at this point, you know?
Yeah, I know in the UK they don't label kids with syndromes too much because, you know, kids change, and a lot of the stuff we go through is just being a kid, right?
Yeah, they can be self-fulfilling prophecies. It's like, you're not good at this, and then you don't develop that part, and you become, you know, somebody that, like, it's like a lobster with one big arm and one small arm.
Mm-hmm.
Comes out like, they should be working themselves out without labels so they could do it organically.
Yeah.
It was a tough blow to have that and not even understand a reference point. I think as I got older, I started to, you know, notice that people had different emotional ranges than I did. They had different relationships than I did. Most people around me kind of, like, they felt and they had ups and downs, and I was kind of like numb and kind of like had one kind of note, and I didn't have a big range. And I think that part of feeling numb and not having the feelings and understanding them, that's almost like harder than having, you know, feelings that are really up and down. I wasn't in touch with any, and that just kept getting worse and worse and worse.
Right.
And I did have in that you know, adolescent part of I did have this amazing cat named Emmett, who was, you know, my savior during that, you know, tough young growing pains time where he and I were really bonded really tightly, and you know, I got so much emotional comfort and physical comfort from my relationship with Emmett, with this cat, when I was very young. And you know, it's been quite some time since Emmett has been with us, but I remember him and you know, his smells and his purrs and his personality like it was yesterday, you know.
Yeah, animals are incredible. And you say that cat was a cat dog. He would wait for you to come home from school.
Exactly.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, some cats are cat dogs and some dogs are dog cats. People like to say I'm a dog person or a cat person. I think there's a lot of through lines in terms of behavior, and I now have a dog cat in a way. I had a cat dog when I was very young.
Right. So, you know, you go on in life, and at one point you're feeling pretty close to the end. Tell us what was going on, and at what point this angel came into your life to turn things around.
Sure. So, I mean, you know, as I continued through the process of, you know, growing up and going through school and going to university and then, you know, becoming a young adult, and like these problems that I had kind of just got worse and worse and worse as everybody else had more of a normal range of emotions and relationships, and you know, kind of evolved, and I wasn't evolving, and I was compensating for that, and I was, you know, just trying to give myself pleasure that I didn't have, and I was doing it through kind of like, you know, addiction to, it sounds funny to say that because most people associate addictions with substances or something else, but I was exercising to the point of oblivion, where I was hurting my body and hurting myself pretty bad.
Mm-hmm.
That was where I was getting kind of, I think, chemically, like the serotonin and norepinephrine of an adrenaline.
Right.
That was kind of helping my brain move, but I injured my back, well, my neck and my back together with herniation, and that stopped everything from sports, and then I had this really big void where I didn't have any of that pleasure at all. So I went from a way to kind of medicate myself to, you know, the exact opposite. And when I had that taken away, I just got darker and darker and darker, and I just felt like the world was, you know, a really bleak, horrible place. And I think, you know, to be human is to kind of feel that way sometimes, because we all, you know, we're precarious. carrier's condition as humans. We know we're mortal, which I learned at a young age, and we have our instincts and our reasons, and those things kind of conflict together sometimes. Part of it's just, you know, it's not special to feel unhappy. It's part of being human.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it got so bad, and I literally just sank darker and darker. I saw the world in this horrible place, and I, you know, ended up in a psychologist's office and discussing with my, you know, psychologist, and he was very helpful, and he said, well, what in my childhood, we had this, you know, understanding that I had such a great relationship with a cat, and helped me so much. He said, well, why don't you get a dog now? And then from that point, I was like, that's a great idea, but I can't even take care of myself. But he convinced me to pursue, to take that jump, and when I did, I found Rosenberg, and came into my life, and when he did, I started, instead of just thinking about my issues and my lack of issues and my lack of feelings and me, I put everything on him. So I put all my focus on his happiness, his socialization, his comforts, his food, and everything that came from an entity of someone else that I wanted to make happy. And I started to feel so good about, you know, doing that. It wasn't about me anymore. And in a way, I was kind of a narcissist. I feel like I didn't understand that. You can kind of get looped into your own loop of problems, and it's, as much as it doesn't feel like it because you're unhappy, it's still kind of a me thing. And I think it's endemic of kind of our society and our culture. And, you know, we look at who our heroes are right now, and the reality TV and our screens and our social media, which I'm on. So clearly there's like contradictions and hypocrisies in all of us, and even what I'm saying. But the point is, it felt really good to give my time and energy into something else and making something else, someone else happy. And he showered me with love back, and we locked into this bond, you know, unconditionally. And I watched him grow and socialize, and it helped me and my confidence. And I started to make some other friends in that world who are also really, like, you know, concerned dog parents. And I was slowly into this scenario of building my confidence and feeling good. And then everyone kept saying how much I look like my animals.
Yes, we'll go into that in a minute. So going back to your point, I think that's so true that, you know, when we're alone and we don't have children, and especially if we don't have a partner. I remember going through a divorce and, you know, feeling that kind of lost feeling. And if I hadn't had a dog, I mean, everybody told me, I wouldn't know you're going through a divorce. You're so emotionally well-balanced. But I wasn't. I waited till I got home to lose it with my dog, and my dog helped me get through it, you know. So I think, you know, we all go through these things, and we tend to focus on how we feel, and having that other living, breathing creature that's dependent on you is important, and it's important that we're there for them.
You don't know, you don't have time if you have to take care of someone else. That's like, it's not, you don't have you don't have the luxury of obsessing over your own stuff sometimes. It's healthy. You know, I have this theory, and just to kind of take it from when I started in a way, it's like, we lose our innocence when we understand our mortality at a certain age, but animals, they never do that. They always kind of don't have the same consciousness that we do. They have a consciousness, but not to the same extent that we do. And they don't think about the fact that they're mortal. And because we lose our innocence when we understand that,
mm-hmm.
we can kind of gain it back through their proximity and perspective. And that, to me, I think has a really alchemic effect on humans through animals. And it's one of the things that they do for us, where we get to, through osmosis, get back to their perspective of innocence and purity, where the world wasn't a harsh place, where people aren't necessarily all going to not be with us. And it kind of, we have a generator of love that I feel like kind of flickers out at some point being human. And there's, they have a battery that replenishes that for us. I think that's the underlying reason of why they have such a cathartic effect on us. And I think that's something I like to talk about, because to me, I think it's good to know the reasons behind things, even when they seem, you know, hard to understand. To me, that makes perfect sense.
Yes, it does. And I know for me, there was a turning point. I just want to get this quote out, but because I read a quote by Gandhi when I was going through a very difficult time, and it
mm-hmm.
said, I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was something about the best way to heal is to be of service to others. And mm-hmm. and I've tried to carry that through my life, through difficult periods, because it's so true.
I think, sorry to cut you off, I just want to say it's why you've dedicated so much time and energy to this amazing show that we're doing right now. I think that's proof positive of what you're saying that you do.
Thank you. And I was looking at some studies this morning, because I've known for a long time that, you know, the connection between petting an animal, you know, studies have shown that the blood pressure drops. And the NIH studies site interacting with animals also shows a decrease in levels of cortisol, the stress-related hormone, and reduces loneliness, increases feelings of social support, and literally dopamine and serotonin, which are, of course, the feel-good hormones. So there are so many ways. I'm wondering, give us a couple of examples, specific examples of how Rosenberg helped you through moments, and what he did and your response and how that came together.
Yeah, so I mean, to your point, so when you know what do animals love, what makes them happy, I learned at an early age when I didn't understand dogs, I understood cats in my life. So, but the similar thing is he just loved to be pet and to be massaged, and that alone, what does that do when you're doing that? It makes you do nothing else but that. You know, you either lock the eyes or you know, your pup is near you, and I would just pet him for such a long time, and it helped our bond, helped him understand that he was safe, and gave him pleasure and gave me pleasure. So that locked me into the present, locked me into him. It's almost like a ritual in a certain way, that you could think about that we do together with our animals, that kind of, again, it's like a meditation because we're present. Right.
Yes.
We're receiving some pleasure. They're receiving some pleasure, and then we're everything else. We have some blinders on. So I mean, that was something that we started to do, and that was incredibly helpful. I mean, very long walks together got me. You know, I couldn't do much exercise, but I could walk, given where my injury was. So that also kind of helped me. You know, we're bipedals as humans. Walking so much was such an amazing thing with him all the time, because he to this day he gets a 4 mile walk every single day. You know, rain or shine. No matter what the weather, but then on our walks, everybody kept saying that, you know, you look alike, and that was kind of a thing that helped me kind of crystallize, you know, the similarities we have and the bond that we have in some way. And I kept saying first, like, that's, you know, that's, we're different species. That's really sweet, but you know, I'm a human, and he's a dog. And then somebody coerced me to put on an outfit that matched him, and I did on a whim. And I don't know if you've been to Prospect Park in Brooklyn. It's a huge park, and huge, and tons of kids and people there, and dog lovers there. And that's the day when I did that on a whim. People started crowding around us, and kids and parents, and a crowd attracted a crowd. And I noticed how happy it made everybody, which made me so happy. You know?
Yes.
And that feeling of seeing not only Rosenberg happy, but other people happy, based on something that we just did on a whim, kind of let off a light in my head where we have something here that's going to help spread happiness and joy to people in a time when there's turmoil. And that was actually in a time when, not to go into specifics, but a specific human being wanted a nomination and looking like the world was going to be changed based on that, and it ended up doing that for many years to this day. So I think that it was like, we need to take this gift that we have organically and spread it to people, and that's when we started to kind of put that on social media, and that was the beginning of our project that brought us to, you know, to talking to you and writing a book about it, which is
right.
I don't know, really truth being stripped in fiction, right?
Right. Well, it's true. Going back to your point, I used to call my dog. My dog died 5 months ago.
I'm sorry for your loss.
Yes, I still miss him. I still cry every day. Every day.
Sure.
I've only just been able to take Border Collie Mom off my bio on Twitter. I know that sounds silly, but I'm sure you understand.
No, listen. The, you know, again, we're all going to perish. We have those. They live forever in our memories, and one day we'll be here too. It's a hard concept to fathom, but it's obviously healthy for us to trace it.
Yeah.
We can.
But I called him a joy spreader because, you know, he would bring joy to people. They just loved him because he was fluffy and he was kind and he was funny and smart. And so, yes, many, 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 many happy memories. So you've got this great Instagram page just talking about how you dressed alike and started dressing alike because you look alike. And so you've got this great Instagram page, which obviously led to the book. So at some point you met Chantal, who's your wife, and she started helping you create this. Is that right?
Yeah, I actually sought her out because I knew we needed a photographer since I didn't have any of those skills. And there happened to be one who specialized in dressing humans and dogs in clothes. So it was a perfect match, and I sought her out, and I... you know, maybe stalked her a little bit too, when she was in my neighborhood, and she decided to take it on as a project, and we started to work together artistically to create these concepts and outfits and so forth, and that was the beginning of a partnership, and, you know, that evolved into, you know, eventually a romantic relationship between us, and, you know, we had this journey together of this kind of connecting project. And then their romance, and that blossomed into her being Rosenberg's mom. And, you know, she grew up, her father passed away when she was quite young, and their family, you know, adopted a dog. And she understood that dogs are family, you know, way before I did in life, you know, when she was 13 years old.
Yeah.
So, in a way, she was such a natural, and Rosenberg took to her so fast. Because she's one of these people where, you know, animals are as important, if not more, than humans to her. So it was a great fit in terms of her as an animal parent. And our, you know, relationship kept evolving, and we ended up getting married and having a human kid. And now we have two human kids, and we have two dogs. Rosenberg has a human brother, a human sister, and a dog sister. So we've come a long way from our beginnings of that relationship, those memories. It's very fun to think about.
Dogs obviously bring us this happiness and this joy and this joie de vivre. They just have this joy of life. I mean, most dogs, not all. I've run into very few who don't have that.
Yeah, I think they naturally do. If there's a reason why they don't, it's something that happened with the nurture, not the nature.
Yes, yes.
So it's somewhat similar that human beings are all... almost we're all brought into the planet to love dogs and dogs to love us, that relationship. It can go wrong if, obviously, the dog is taught wrong or the human's taught not to like dogs. But if you show a kid, a baby, a dog photo, a puppy photo, our synapses all light up because we've evolved together for 30,000 plus years to be compatible. And that's what's so special about it. I mean, animals are all beautiful to me, but the relationship between humans and dogs and cats too, but dogs specifically, we've evolved together, so we're so compatible. And I like to refer to them as nature's clergy, or the first animals, which connect us to nature. They're the portals for us to remember our own part of being part of nature and being animals ourselves, obviously with big complicated brains, but they're the ones that connect us back to that. And we got to remember that, because when we think that we're above nature, that's when we've been destroying it. You know, we think that because we have our religions that we're above these animals, and we're not. We are animals, and we need to be back in harmony, and that relationship should be grounding us and helping us remember that, you know?
Right, right. And there are many, many, many lessons we can learn from animals of all kind. I want to get a little bit more serious about this for a second, because I think this is an important point, Topher, in that... several years ago, I was watching Dr. Phil. I saw Madeline Bernstein on there, who was president of the Los Angeles ASPCA. And I thought, I have to talk to that woman. And so she came on the show, and we talked about her book called Designer Dogs, An Exposé Inside the Criminal World, Underworld of Crossbreeding. Now, you've got this great Instagram page. It's fun. It's whimsical. But there are people who go to extremes with making animal videos and stuff like that. One of the reasons I wanted to do that particular show was to shine a light on that. It's up on our website if anybody wants to catch it. But you don't like us calling animals, pets. So talk to us a little bit about that, if you would.
Sure. I mean, you know, the word pet, I mean, I'm not somebody that, you know, harps on this point ad nauseum, because I think shaming anyone for anything is wrong.
Right.
So I think if the negative energy is not good for anybody, I think we can all learn from, you know, giving positive energy and so forth, rather than, you know, chiding somebody. But the word pet itself is, it's a bit demeaning. It implies subservience and a, you know, it's almost like an owner. An owner to me is also a word I don't like. It, you know, implies ownership and kind of a master-slave relationship in a way. It's they're both just not indicative of the place that dogs have in our lives, where they're our companions, and we owe them for helping us really survive when we were competing against other Homo species. You know, like, it's like, this is, they didn't help us hunt, they didn't help us have our security systems, they didn't help us transportation back when we were, you know, coming out of caves. To have us, you know, demean them and speak to them in ways and refer them in ways, I think it also helps us treat them better when we treat them and refer to them. Words matter. So if you refer to them as a companion, not a pet, I feel like it helps people treat them with the dignity and the care they deserve. So it's one of those things where I just like to refer to it in the way that I do, but I'm never going to correct anybody.
Your love battery. That's what you call Rosenberg, right? Your love battery.
Yes.
Exactly. Yeah.
Oh, in terms of the dog videos that you're saying, so is this referring to people that kind of...
Well, you know, I'm very, very cautious on social media about liking videos of, like, animal rescues, for example, because I think in some cases those are set up.
Interesting.
Yeah, I've actually seen, well, I actually saw a prosecution. I watched it from start to finish of some kids who'd thrown, I think it was a Labrador puppy, into a river just to watch it drift away and then, quote, rescue it. So, I mean, that kind of stuff goes on, and, you know, we need to be aware of it, and we're not trying to humanize animals in this discussion, but they still have their animal instinct and everything. But I think the thing is, with a lot of the social media stuff, and your page is not in that category, I do feel kind of sorry for some of those animals and the things that they go through, which is why I loved yours so much, because it's very whimsical. It's obvious the dog loves it. Obviously, Rosenberg loves it. And it's just something I think to keep in mind for people when they're looking through social media about, you know,
I think it's a good point. I mean, you know, just to use this opportunity, I just want to say, like, you know, we've used social media for our purposes of getting exposure and spreading our messages and, you know, trying to pull people together as dog people.
Yes.
And having our kind of a big unison and bond together for all those reasons. But social media inherently can obviously be used for the wrong reasons, and often, you know, for narcissism or just for straight capitalism, which is something we, you know, do a lot in this country for good and for bad. But that's kind of like a big reason why our philosophy has been that make people laugh and then make them listen. You know, get the attention with
exactly
wild photos and some antics, but then go on the side of that whole thing and put the messages in there in a way that's not right in front and center, because who wants to be preached at? I think I don't want to be, nor would I want anyone else to suffer that kind of preaching thing. So I think that's a good point. I mean, I think social media in general is a very easy vehicle for narcissism, and I think it's very dangerous for all of us. It's one of those things where we can't turn back the clock, we can't all be Luddites, but we can try to use what we can for the right reasons and highlight the wrong ones. I mean,
yeah,
you know, an issue that I have on social media is people, I feel like everybody's hawking something all the time, and everybody wants to sell products all the time, and some people who I like a lot on in entertainment, I feel like they always have this, every day it's they're selling this, they're selling that, they're selling this, they're selling that. It's like, come on.
Yeah. Well, I want to point this
break,
out.
You know?
Yeah, and I want to point this out to listeners that all your proceeds from this book are going to support American Humane. And that's an organization that's been around since 1877, I looked up.
Yes.
And so I'm wondering, what made you choose American Humane? Because there are some awesome organizations out there. These guys, American Humane, have done some great work. especially with animal cruelty in Hollywood, for example.
Oh yeah, I think that's part of how they're on our radar. So we've done some entertainment stuff, and through that we got to know this organization, because they're always the ones on set, you know. And obviously, you know, nothing's ever always going to be perfect, but they do a hell of a job protecting animals and looking out for the well-being. They have so many different departments. They have an animal rescue division, which is where we're donating all of our proceeds. You know, they have No Harm on Sets, which is huge. They have a great one for farm animals.
Yes.
They have a great, you know, for vets and dogs, to help, obviously, people that have PTSD. But they put all their money, humanly possible, towards the actual results, towards the rescue and to helping animals. And they're just good people that we just kind of get along with and we trust, because I feel like the worst thing is charities that you don't know where the money goes or how people behave. It's very hard to understand all that stuff, but they have a really, really spotless, you know, rating system, and I think that goes a long way. And they've just been friends over the years, so they're the perfect. We just wanted to let people know too that everything doesn't have to be for yourself, in terms of financially. It felt really good to do something for somebody else. Again, it's part of the, you know, the quote that you mentioned from Gandhi. Mother Teresa says something similar too, where, sorry, I didn't mean to, I'm not comparing herself to Mother Teresa. I'm just saying, she said that, why do you do good things? She goes, oh, because I'm selfish, because it helps, makes me feel good.
And it does. And there's nothing wrong with that.
Right.
There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, you realize what makes you feel good and not good. And I've felt not good for so long. I find things that make me feel good. So it is a selfish act, just to be blunt.
Well, I felt good just looking at your Instagram page. It's really funny. And I'm curious, I have to ask you this, Topher. Did you grow your beard to look like your dog, or did you already have that when you adopted Rosenberg?
No, there's been various periods of beard and no beard. So I go back and forth. I currently have no beard. In fact, so I think it's just one of those things where I might have too much, to use a psychology term, transference or countertransference to know the answer to that. I think it all just seemed to work out itself.
And so, you know, this book, were you writing it after the pandemic? Is that correct?
Yeah, it started during the pandemic, actually, yeah.
And so,
I guess technically we're still in the pandemic, so yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
I think we are. So what did you learn about yourself as you're remembering your story and you're writing it and telling these stories?
Good question. You know, I'll never forget the experience. I mean, when you, again, we all suffer, so it's not special. My story isn't special to have this human suffering. It's all part of all of us. But I feel like our greatest strengths come from our hardships, and it's like remembering that those things can kind of build you into something new, and those things can help you empathize and connect with other people, since we all kind of suffer or have a similar template. I was just kind of going back to those feelings, which I had for most of my life, but you know, now I feel a lot better for so many reasons. But it just brought me back to kind of the origins of, you know, those memories, and you know, there's always opportunities for us to kind of find ways to improve ourselves, even when we feel like that it's impossible. It's always possible, and I think that's kind of something I keep going back to for people. And I wanted people to know that if they're suffering now, just to hold on, you know, just to hold on, and things will get better if you hold on. Things will get better if you start living for other people, not yourself.
Right.
I was remembering those feelings that I had, like, you know, being young and not feeling out of place, or having bad acne, or, you know, getting rejected by somebody, and reliving those feelings just made me more appreciate the circumstance that that I'm in now, which is all catalyzed by my relationship with animals.
Yeah.
You know, so I those memories were nostalgic and painful, but also kind of happy with kind of where we're at, I think, and how I've grown.
Yeah.
But it was really fun. Although hard and a lot of late nights, not a lot of sleep for a long time.
Well, no, not with a growing family too. And, you know, and I echo that. I mean, I think back, you know, throughout my life, and animals have been so key. I mean, right from, you know, I was a baby, we always had dogs in our house and other animals, because my father, for one thing, said it teaches you the cycle of life. And secondly, it teaches you responsibility to be responsible for someone other than yourself. We could not have an animal if we did not take care of it. And, you know, an animal in the home is family, as you said, and they're there for life, in at least in my family.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the saddest thing is when people have children and they give up their animals. To me, that's like something I have so much tolerance, but I have no tolerance for people that, I mean, the animals, their word is good. They love unconditionally. We have to learn from that. That's why, like, you know, it's like, what would your dog do? You know, use them as the example to, you know, live presently, to judge people based on the love they give you and not by superficial things. And they don't look at us that way. There's so many ways we can look at the way they treat us and how we can kind of live better. And, you know, part of the whole part of the book, the subtext is, you know, how we can make the world a better place and help save the world by channeling kind of a lot of things that they teach us, to enjoy the moments we're in, to be present, again, treat people based on how they treat us, like a love meritocracy, you know, have fun and tap back into our playful side, which we lose when we're quite young, some of us, and they always have it. So that's such a great place for us to kind of get back into that kind of nostalgia of playfulness that they always have. And, you know, to basically keep the pack together, you know?
Yeah.
Like, we all have this pack, and I think animal people are all in a pack, despite all our differences. So these are all like, what would your dog do in a scenario? Obviously, you can't use that for certain things because we're so different, but I think it applies to a lot of things with our big brains that we get conflicted on and crunched on between our instincts and our reason. Sometimes we overcomplicate stuff, and they can kind of help us go back to our guts, and that helps us kind of make decisions and kind of live better, you know?
Yes, yeah. You know, I'll just share a little story about my dog, because he was two, and I drove down to Oregon to take a look at him. I wasn't in a place where I wanted where I needed a dog, I thought, because I was traveling all the time. But I wanted one because I'd never been without one. And the second I saw him, I just couldn't let his face go. I saw him on a website. And so I drove down about 3 weeks later to see him, and his foster mum would not let him go until she found him a forever home, because he'd already had four homes. So she vetted me very carefully, and I said, no, if I take him, he's mine, you know, he's with us forever. And he died, like I said, 5 months ago at the age of 17. But it was not easy getting him to settle in, because it's like I felt he was depressed, as though, and I talking with my mom about it, she said, he probably is wondering, when is she going to give me up? Get down on the floor and talk to him. And so I lay on the floor and I told him, you're not going anywhere, buddy. You're here for life, like it or not. And we had such an incredible bond. I can't express it.
I love hearing this. It really warms my heart. It's really beautiful.
Yeah. So I really appreciated talking with you. I appreciate the work you're doing. I love Rosenberg and the photos up on your Instagram page. Great work. And I also love the fact that you're giving all of your profits, all of your author income off this book, Dog Dad, How Animals Bring Out the Best in Us and Can Help Save the World. And you're donating those to American Humane. So a final thought, Topher, you'd like to leave our listeners with. I know they can find out much more about you and the work you're doing at topherbrophy.com.
Yes, thank you. Final thought, I would just make sure everybody, if you haven't experienced the love of an animal, it's something that's going to improve your life. It's going to add years to your life. It's going to lower your blood pressure. It's going to help you exercise. It's going to help your happiness and your relationships with humans. So give it a shot. And if you already have an animal that you love, congratulations. It's amazing. And further channel that into kind of thinking about the, you know, when you're walking and you're petting, and kind of it's like a ritual of sorts. And I think spiritually it can kind of help us all by being present and thinking about things that aren't ourselves. Sometimes framing it in a way that we already know is even more helpful too. And then that all animal people, we're all in a family, you know. I think in this day of divisiveness, it's important to think about things that we have in common, and we all love our animals. And I think that's beautiful, and I think they're really going to help us as we evolve with technology. It's going to bring us back our our relationship with animals, to remembering where we came from. I think it's more important as time goes on. I think we only scratch the surface of how much they can help us. And I just want to say, everybody, thank you for listening. I appreciate you.
And we appreciate you, Topher Brophy. Thank you so much for being with us today. Thank you.
My pleasure.
If you have questions, comments, or feedback regarding today's podcast, you can reach me on our website at conversationslive.net. Thanks for joining us today. We'll have a new podcast go live next Wednesday. Until then, live well, live strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.